Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison, and I'm going to take you through developments of interest in the last 30 days in public safety labor news. And boy, do we have two important cases to talk about this time. The first, this is going to be a shock to nobody, is the Friedrichs case from the U.S. Supreme Court and the whole issue of fair share. The second thing that I want to talk about is a wonderful case that comes to us out of Chicago. And by wonderful, I'm not talking about the result. I'm talking about the analysis in the case. A wonderful case that comes to us that discusses what I would refer to as impact bargaining, where an employer may be able to make a decision about an issue, but ends up getting tangled up in the obligation to collectively bargain over the impact of the decision. The Chicago case involves new regulations concerning tattoos in the Chicago Police Department, but I use it more as an illustration of this very important principle that we're seeing discussed a lot right now of impact bargaining. But first, let's talk about the Friedrichs case. What we got on March 29th of 2016 were nine incredibly important words from the Supreme Court. And those nine words were, the judgment is affirmed by an equally divided court. What is up with all of this? First of all, let me just set the stage for you a little bit about what Friedrichs is all about. Because I'm going to have to do that so you understand the significance of the court's decision in March. Friedrichs is about the constitutionality of something called fair share. Fair share is a concept that's been around for a long time. The basic notion is that where in the public sector you cannot compel union membership, what you can compel non-members of a union to do, if they're in a bargaining unit that's represented by a union, what you can compel non-members to do is to pay their fair share of the costs of negotiating and administering the collective bargaining agreement. At the notion of it is really a concept of, I think, economic fairness, and that is that unions provide to both members and non-members benefits that are tangible benefits. Non-members get the benefit of the same collective bargaining agreement that union members do, the same wage schedule, the same vacations and health insurance and all of those sorts of things. Also, unions have a duty of fair representation to non-members. They can't say, for example, we're not going to take your disciplinary appeal because you're a non-member. They can't discriminate on the basis of union membership or non-membership for the purposes of providing representation. So what fair share gets at is that because non-members get these benefits from a union, they should pay something to the union. But not full dues. Behind the notion of fair share is that non-members should only pay costs that are related to or arise out of the negotiations or administration of a collective bargaining agreement. So there are some costs that a union incurs that are clearly germane to the collective bargaining process. For example, the cost of hiring a professional negotiator or hiring an attorney to handle grievances or things like that, rent, those are all related to the collective bargaining process. But there are some costs that a union incurs that aren't related to collective bargaining in any way, shape, or form. For example, police unions, fire unions, corrections unions will often have Christmas parties. That's not related to the bargaining process. They will often support kids programs. You might see a Kinderprint program. The Firefighters International Association of Firefighters says for a long time encouraged its locals to assist in the battle against muscular dystrophy and collecting funds for the Muscular Dystrophy Association. That's not related to the collective bargaining process. So what you end up with is a sort of an accounting where you have some costs that are chargeable to fair share members, some that are not, And the result is that fair share assessments are less than full union dues. I typically see them somewhere around 85, 90, 95% of full union dues. Now, the Supreme Court in 1977, so we're talking now almost 40 years ago, we're talking 38 years ago, in 1977, 39 years ago, the Supreme Court decided a case called Abood, A-B-O-O-D, involving the city of Detroit, on whether fair share was constitutional. So what's the argument there? In particular, what's the argument since the court has ruled on a number of occasions that political contributions are not germane to the collective bargaining agreement, and you can't charge fair share members for political contributions? The argument from those who object to fair share, and an argument the Supreme Court had to consider in the Abood case in 1977, was that everything that a public sector union does is political in nature. When you, for example, bargain for the wages of a firefighter, you're setting public policy. Public policy that allocates certain funds and by exclusion, diverts those funds from other purposes to which they might be used. So since everything is political in nature, and since you can't force somebody, you meaning the government, can't force somebody to engage in political speech, and since, as the Supreme Court has told us many times, money is politics, the argument goes that you simply can't have a fair share in the public sector without violating the First Amendment free speech rights of non-members. The Supreme Court in 1977 rejected that argument and said, yeah, we get it. We get that politics of speech. We get that unions are going to be engaged in something that kind of sort of looks like political speech, even if you carve out campaign contributions. But there's something on the other side of the equation. In these constitutional law cases, we balance interests of the government against interests of individuals, and we find the interests of the government here outweigh the interests in the individuals. And what's the interest of the government? Labor peace. Not having a bargaining unit torn up by some non-members demanding and getting the same union services without paying for them. Or is what unions call it, the free rider problem. And so the Supreme Court said, on balance, fair share is constitutional. All right, that's 38 years ago. What was going on leading up to the Friedrichs case? What was going on is the Supreme Court changed in its political complexion. It became much more politically conservative. And as it became politically conservative, its decisions have become almost predictably resolved against unions. By my count, unions and employees have lost 46 of the last 49 cases decided by the Supreme Court involving labor rights. And, of course, a record of 46-3 from the employer standpoint, that's not an accident. That's an ideology. Yeah, and many of those decisions have been by the same 5-4 majority of the Supreme Court, with all five of the justices in the majority who rule against unions and rule for employers, with all five of them being appointed by Republican presidents. It's a very politicized court right now, maybe the most politicized in any of our lifetimes, and arguably the most politicized Supreme Court in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. And you quite frequently see these 5-4 decisions. Well, of those five justices who have been dominating the court's direction for the last 12 years or so, of the five, four have taken the opportunity over the last few years to drop hints that if only someone would bring us the right case, we'd like to overrule Friedrichs, and we'd like to declare fair share unconstitutional. Four justices have said that, and a fifth has dropped more obscure hints about it. Well, that case is Friedrichs. It was brought by a teacher, several of them, but the lead teacher is named Rebecca Friedrichs out of California. And she was assisted by a nonprofit group that gets involved in a lot of these fair share cases. It's called the Right to Work Foundation out of Virginia. It's not going to shock anybody when I tell you that one of the main financial contributors to the Right to Work Foundation are the Koch brothers, who have so dominated the political discussion in this country in the last few years. Friedrichs and her cohorts objected to fair share, and that's the case that got to the Supreme Court. Oral argument on the case was held in January of this year, and nothing about the four justices who've been dropping these hints saying we want to overturn the constitutionality of fair share, none of those four justices said anything to indicate they had changed their minds at all. One of them, Justice Thomas, didn't speak. That's nothing new. He went a 10-year period without saying anything in an oral argument. And the other three said things that indicated that they still wanted to overturn the Abood decision and hold fair share unconstitutional. A fifth justice, the one who had been a little bit murky on the issue, was actually the most savage to fair share, and that was Justice Antonin Scalia. Justice Scalia in the past had indicated some support for the notion of fair share, indicating he understood the free rider problem, but it was pretty apparent from his comments in the oral argument in January that he changed his mind. And pretty much everybody thought the Supreme Court was going to decide by this very familiar 5-4 margin that fair share is unconstitutional. And then weeks later, just before Valentine's Day, Justice Scalia died, as you know. And all of a sudden, we have this situation in Friedrichs that we had with many cases that are pending before the Supreme Court, where instead of looking at a 5-4 decision, we're now looking at a 4-4 decision. And on March 29th, 2016, we got that decision. The judgment is affirmed by an equally divided court. What's up with that? Well, the Supreme Court has had this happen, of course, many times in the past, where there have been only an equal number of justices on the court, or because one of them has a conflict of interest, instead of 9, you have 8 justices deciding a case. There's even a time in our history where we only had an even number of justices on the court. So it's nothing that's new. And the most common way the Supreme Court resolves that issue is to issue a very brief decision. They're called per curiam decisions. They're not signed decisions. And when you have a tie, whatever the lower court held is upheld. The decision is affirmed. And so then you have to go back to the lower court. What did the lower court decide in Friedrichs? What it decided is fair share is constitutional. The lower court said, because we've got this Abood case that's still good law 38, 39 years ago, because we have the Abood case, we're bound to follow it. And therefore, fair share is alive and well in this country, thanks to this equally divided court. You're going to see this come up in, I predict, before the end of the court's term in June. You're going to see this come up in a number of cases. There's a number of pretty important cases, and some abortion cases, some business cases, where it looked like you were headed for a 5-4 decision with Justice Scalia in the majority. Those are all going to be 4-4 cases now. We're going to have an interesting time in the court's history. So what about the future of fair share? Well, it all comes down to what the replacement for Justice Scalia thinks, right? Initially, of course, when Justice Scalia passed away, you heard immediate as in within hours, public pronouncements from prominent Republicans in the Senate, which does the confirming of Supreme Court justices. We heard immediate pronouncements that they were not going to hold any hearings, much less confirm anybody that President Obama nominated to replace Justice Scalia. Their phrasing of it is, we ought to let the voters decide who the next justice of the Supreme Court should be. I'm going to stay away from the politics of all that and the history of all that. Let's just say that my judgment is both parties come to this whole discussion without perfectly clean hands, if you will. But that was the immediate public pronouncement. Then President Obama shocked everybody by nominating Judge Merrick Garland to replace Justice Scalia. Why was that a shock? It was it's a shock primarily because of Judge Garland's age. He's in his 60s, and the thought was that President Obama would probably follow the lead of a number of presidents, most prominently the last President Bush, and nominate a justice in their 40s who might be able to serve for 20 or 30 or 40 years. And it was also a shock because Judge Garland is not a political ideologue. He's been on the District of Columbia Court of Appeals for a long time. He's issued a whole bunch of decisions, and he is, I would call him, but I'm going to use the word very differently than I did a little bit ago, he's a conservative judge. And I don't mean, in this case, politically conservative. I mean conservative from a jurisprudential standpoint. You look at Judge Garland's opinions, and he's not out to make new law. He's not out to make public policy with his decisions. He seems to be somebody who has a very instinctive desire to follow whatever precedent is out there and to keep his decisions as narrow as they possibly can be. So if you can decide something on a procedural basis without getting into a broad public policy issue, that's where Judge Garland's going to go. In other words, he's a judge who's like the jurisprudential opposite of Justice Scalia. But he's also not an ideologue. You can't really go through his opinions and find a whole lot that suggests that this is someone who is politically conservative or politically liberal. Well, that nomination clearly threw the whole process of the Senate confirmation for a loop. All of a sudden, you started seeing a softening in the Senate Republicans, at least some of them, particularly the ones up for re-election this year, started seeing a softening in their position as to whether or not they were going to hold hearings to confirm Judge Garland. Now, some of them are now saying, well, you know, we may not hold hearings, but we'll at least talk to the guy privately. And Judge Garland is starting to meet with these senators. You still have the official position of President of the Senate, Senator McConnell. The official position is we're not going to hold hearings on anybody. Certainly the three declared presidential candidates, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and John Kasich, all are saying there should be no hearings for any nominee. The undeclared candidate, the one who the Koch brothers threw their support behind this week, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, has said the same thing. And you have the Democrats, of course, saying let's hold hearings right away. We saw this interesting moment of political theater a little while ago where we were looking at the, you know, you look at the polls and you see the Democrats pretty clearly winning the presidency this year as things stand right now as I'm dictating this. And then you saw Senator McConnell, I think, looking at the same poll saying, you know what, we're not going to hold any hearings, but we'll reassess that position after the results of the general election and before the new president takes office. In other words, you know, Garland may not be that bad. If we are looking at a President Sanders or a President Clinton, they may nominate somebody who is an ideologue. So let's just make that decision about whether we're going to hold hearings after we see the results of the general election. And the political theater came because the Democrats then assigned Al Franken, the senator from Minnesota and former cast member of Saturday Night Live. They assigned him to respond to Senator McConnell. I'm not going to go into what he had to say, but trust me, it was more Saturday Night Live than it was senatorial, and it was said on the Senate floor. It just looks like right now, unless things break, unless something really changes, it looks like it may not be Merrick Garland, who's going to replace Justice Scalia, which means, back to fair share, I think that's what I was talking about, that which means the future of fair share comes down to who wins the presidential election and who they nominate to the Supreme Court. This is a presidential election where it may well be, and I hope this isn't just my lawyer bias shining through here, it may well be the most important thing that we are resolving when we vote is the future of the Supreme Court. There are four justices on the Supreme Court who, during the term of the next president, will be in their 80s. And that's not even counting Justice Scalia. We could be looking at, if we have a president who does nominate younger judges, we could be looking at a president who's going to determine the composition of the Supreme Court for 30 years or 40 years. So this presidential election is not just going to tell us the future of fair share, although it will, it may tell us a lot more. But in the meantime, fair share alive and well in this country. Let's talk tattoos. Actually, what I really want to talk about is impact bargaining, but it's tattoos that give us the appropriate context to talk about it. So the case I want to talk about is an arbitrator's decision, as I mentioned, that comes out of the Chicago Police Department. Just a little bit by way of background, there are a number of police unions in Chicago. Lodge 7 of the Fraternal Order of Police represents employees in the police officer job classification. Prior to 2015, the department had no policy banning the display of visible tattoos. And it just seems to have not been an issue. Lodge 7 and the city had never even discussed the topic of tattoo regulations during bargaining. Well, as sometimes happens, you end up with a change in department administration, police or fire department administration. And in this case, that's what occurred here. And they decided that they wanted to address the topic of tattoos. The vehicle was a policy that was put into place on June 8th of 2015. It was called Personal Appearance, Uniform, Citizen's Dress, and Equipment Policy. And the policy got into loving detail about how officers could look on the job. The policy regulated hairstyles. It regulated, I'm sure you're waiting for this, fingernail color and fingernail ornamentation. Can't leave that alone. Talked about the number of buttons that could be unbuttoned on a sweater. It even addressed the color of socks, the color of eyeglasses, and what wristwatches could look like. It just went on and on and on. This is a pretty amazing policy. And it talked about tattoos. And here's what it says. For civilian and sworn members, tattoos and body brandings will not be visible while on duty or representing the department, whether in uniform, conservative business attire, or casual dress. Okay, no visible tattoos or body brandings. By the way, will someone who's out there who knows just send me an email, and you can do it at will@lris.com, and tell me what the difference is between a tattoo and a body branding? I just have no idea. Okay, but that issue aside, the policy goes on to say that that members who do have tattoos that would be visible have to wear long sleeve shirts, no matter what the time of year, or the way that policy is phrased is regardless of season. It talks about having a uniform dress code for units that are particularly visible, so that, for example, if you have one person who has to cover up their tattoos because of they would be visible, they have to wear a long sleeve shirt, everybody in that unit has to wear the long sleeve shirts because they want uniformity of appearance. It's quite a detailed policy on tattoos. It also indicates that members cannot wear short sleeve shirts with tattoo cover-up arm sleeves. Well, Lodge 7 took a look at that and said, whoa, wait a minute. We got lots of members with tattoos, and you didn't bargain over this. You didn't negotiate with us. You can't do that under our collective bargaining agreement, and you also can't do it under Illinois' labor laws. So what Lodge 7 did was to file two things. Filed a grievance saying you're violating the collective bargaining agreement by unilaterally implementing this tattoo policy. And secondly, it filed an unfair labor practice complaint with Illinois' Labor Relations Board. And the gravamen of the unfair labor practice complaint was you've made a unilateral change in a mandatory subject of bargaining. Well, the Labor Board gets at the issue first and decides we're not going to decide it. Decides that, look, you got a grievance pending, and it may well be that the grievance resolves this issue, so we're going to hold our proceedings in abeyance pending the arbitration. And so the case goes to arbitration, and this is really on a fast-track arbitration. Remember, I told you this policy is implemented on June 8th of 2015, and we already have an arbitrator's decision. And what the arbitrator ends up doing is siding with the FOP, sides with Lodge 7, and rules that the department can't unilaterally implement the tattoo policy. Now, the arbitrator, it's kind of a bit of a confusing arbitration decision. We're happy to email it to you, by the way, if you'd like the arbitrator's decision. And we'll also post it on the LRIS webpage, like we post every case that we talk about on these podcasts. You'll find the arbitrator's decision kind of meanders a little bit and never really, I don't think, concretely decides whether or not the employer had to bargain over the decision to implement this new grooming code, this new tattoo policy. You know, whether it could or whether it couldn't implement a decision without bargaining. I think the arbitrator may say the decision here is not mandatory for bargaining, but it's not clear. And you know what? It doesn't matter because the arbitrator found that there were mandatorily negotiable impacts from the decision. So without regard to whether the employer had to bargain over the decision, it did have to bargain over the impacts, and it couldn't implement the policy before it bargained over the impacts. And what does bargaining mean? Well, in the context of Illinois law, bargaining means you sit down at the table, can't reach an agreement, you end up in arbitration, and an arbitrator decides the issue. Illinois is, like the majority of collective bargaining states, is a binding arbitration state. It's not a meet and confer state. So the notion that the city had to bargain over the impacts, it's a big deal. It means that eventually, if they can't reach an agreement, this is a decision that has to be rendered by an arbitrator. So why is a tattoo policy, why does it have mandatorily negotiable impacts? So let me read to you a little bit. I'm not going to quote it extensively. Read to you a little bit from the arbitrator's opinion, because it's great impact bargaining analysis. And again, when I say words like great in describing a decision on these podcasts, I don't mean I like the result. What I mean is I really like the way the court or the arbitrator sets forth the analysis, because I think it's really helpful for all of us in looking at these cases, that sort of analysis. The arbitrator says, first, look, you got a longstanding past practice. You got all sorts of officers who've been hired with tattoos, and they've gotten tattoos during their employment with no negative consequences. The arbitrator refers to this new policy as a, and I'm quoting here, a major change in the employee's working conditions. And the arbitrator is clearly critical of the city's decision-making process and rationale for the tattoo policy, because the arbitrator actually says that the policy, this about face, her phrase, in how the department views policies is, and I'm quoting, without apparent reason. And the arbitrator also describes the policy as turning acceptable behavior in the workplace to the equivalent of criminal conduct, meaning the officers would basically maybe be forced to ultimately forfeit their job. So if they wanted tattoos. So arbitrator saying, number one, major change in working conditions here has disciplinary consequences. That makes the regulation of tattoos mandatory for bargaining. Secondly, the arbitrator says a tattoo is forever, essentially forever. And here's, now I will quote from the arbitrator's opinion. Removal of a tattoo, even if the officers were willing to take that step, is an expensive and painful process. This is far different from regulating the length of hair, fingernails, or sideburns, or requiring employees to remove jewelry from piercings. An individual who has a tattoo has a tattoo. Isn't that wonderful writing, by the way? Boy, I wish I could have written that. And there's nothing he can do to avoid falling within the scope of this policy. And then the third thing the arbitrator says, and I really love this part of her opinion, is that this is Chicago that we are talking about here. Here's what she writes. It's, you'll see why I think this is delightful. The evidence demonstrates what common sense indicates, that compliance with the new policy carries significant adverse consequences to employees. Where officers with visible tattoos on their arms had been allowed to wear open-collared short-sleeve shirts in the summer, they must now wear their regular long-sleeve shirts and ties. Here comes the Chicago thing. Anyone who has spent a summer in Chicago can take notice of the fact that wearing a long-sleeve shirt with a tie rather than an open-neck short-sleeve shirt would cause a huge comfort difference if one spent even a few minutes outside on a hot day, let alone the hours so spent by many officers. The arbitrator also talks about other impacts. For example, if you have one person who's on motorcycles, they're going to have to wear long sleeve shirts, which means everybody in the motorcycle unit, whether they have tattoos or not, will have to wear long sleeve shirts. And the arbitrator talks about what that's like for a motorcycle officer in the summertime. The arbitrator ends up saying there's just a lot about a tattoo policy that is mandatory for bargaining. So what? How do we end up? The arbitrator says the employer had to bargain the impact of the decision before it implemented. And by the way, that's the rule everywhere that I know of. The employer has to complete its bargaining obligations before implementation. So the arbitrator holds that the employer has to rescind the policy, expunge discipline that is related to the policy, and also, and I'll quote here again, make whole those employees who can demonstrate that they have expended funds in their attempts to comply with the policy. It's a wonderful impact bargaining case. It lays out that the employer has this obligation to bargain over the impact of decisions, that where the impact may be mandatory for bargaining, even if the decision itself is non-negotiable. The remedy is, I think, a very standard remedy that you'd see a labor board or an arbitrator or a court award in these sorts of situations. And it demonstrates the very clear bias that labor boards and courts have about this whole issue of making changes in policies that affect working conditions. And that bias is, bargain about it. Don't implement and then pick up the pieces afterwards. Recognize that you have a bargaining obligation and discharge it before you make a unilateral change. One postscript to this. I found this really ironic, this new policy regulating tattoos. You've probably noticed police, fire, corrections, employers around the country are going the other direction on tattoos. We have a generation now that is more tattoo prone than the prior generation. And particularly in law enforcement, we're in the biggest hiring crisis of our lifetimes. We just can't hire people to be cops in this country. And so you see police departments around the country relaxing their tattoo rules. It seemed very ironic to find, you know, one of the biggest cities in the country, Chicago, with one of the most oppressive weather patterns, particularly in the summer, all of a sudden banning visible tattoos. It seemed like an odd thing to do when we're trying to get more and more people with more and more diverse backgrounds to be cops in this country. Next up, we've got a comp time case out of New York that it doesn't really make new law, but I want to use it to emphasize a principle of the FLSA that's been floating around out there. Okay, background a little bit. Prior to 1985, comp time was illegal under the FLSA. There had been lots of court decisions finding that comp time really could not be used as a substitute for cash compensation for overtime. Well, in 1985, we had the Garcia decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that applied the FLSA to the public sector for the first time. And then Congress swung into action months after the Garcia decision in November of 1985, and passed several new sections of the FLSA that only pertain to public employees. And one of those new sections was Section 70, if you're counting Title 29 of the United States Code, Section 2070. What Section 70 said was comp time is legal in the public sector, provided the comp time meets, depending on how you count, seven different tests. And Section 70, you can see, requires, for example, the comp time be on a time and a half basis. There's no such thing as straight time comp time under the FLSA. It requires that comp time can't be forfeited. It requires that it be cashed out at the termination of an employee's service, at the employee's then current regular rate of pay. There's all sorts of requirements for legal comp time under the FLSA. And one of them is there has to be an agreement to use comp time as a substitute for cash. And the way Section 70 works and the Department of Labor's rules that interpret and apply Section 70 works is if you're in a non-union situation, the agreement has to be reached with individual employees on a one-on-one basis and actually can even be imposed as a condition of employment by the employer. But if you're in a union situation, which most public safety employees are, the agreement has to be with the labor organization. And so in order to use comp time in the public sector, if you've got a union somewhere on the scene, there has to be an agreement with the union to use comp time. And that agreement can spell out the terms and conditions of the accrual and use of comp time. Just can't be less generous than Section 70 provides. So what's the issue in this New York case? This is a case that comes out of the village of Muttontown, New York, where you have a new labor union on the scene, new police union on the scene. The employees haven't apparently been organized in the past. And the village and the union are sitting down for their first collective bargaining agreement, negotiations over their first contract. The union is the PBA in New York. And one of the proposals that's on the table is from the village, and it is that comp time should be used instead of cash for overtime, and that the employer can unilaterally designate when an officer works overtime whether the officer is going to be paid in cash or comp time. The PBA and the village are unable to reach an agreement on the contract, and so they get ready to go to binding arbitration. And one of the steps in New York under the bargaining law there is that the Public Employment Relations Board, PERB as it's called in New York, has to decide whether or not the issues that are being submitted to arbitration are themselves mandatory for bargaining. You can only send to arbitration something that may be negotiated under the law. If it is an illegal subject of bargaining, then it cannot go to arbitration. And the question that PERB, and in particular, this is a decision from an administrative law judge, an ALJ has to decide this case, is whether or not the village's proposal that allows it to designate whether or not overtime is paid in the form of cash or comp time, whether or not that's legal, whether that's legal under Section 70 of the FLSA. And the ALJ, following several other decisions in other states that have held to the same effect, says it's not legal. Why is it not legal? It's not legal because you got to have this voluntary agreement to use comp time. And you guys are headed to binding arbitration. An arbitrator's going to decide this contract. And an arbitrator would decide this comp time issue. That's not a voluntary agreement. That is an imposed collective bargaining agreement. So you cannot, by definition, have a voluntary imposed decision, and therefore you cannot have comp time in the public sector where the agreement is produced by an arbitrator's decision. It's got to be a voluntary, arm's length, negotiated agreement to use comp time. As I said, nothing really special about this decision. There have been other cases that have held exactly the same thing, but I think it's a good reminder about the complex way these federal laws can interplay into relatively small issues that appear in a public safety collective bargaining agreement. All right, now I want to get complicated with you for a moment. Not too complicated, but a little bit. But we've got a Brady decision that has come out. And I think it's important enough that we really do need to talk about it a little bit. Brady, of course, is this long ago decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, Brady versus Maryland, that is now being interpreted as obliging a prosecutor to potentially disclose police personnel files and internal investigations files in criminal prosecutions. And you have, I've talked about it in these podcasts before, you have some prosecutors who have created so-called Brady lists, where officers who have potentially disclosable information are placed on the list. And that can have very serious job consequences for officers in that they could potentially be terminated if they're placed on a Brady list or suspended or reassigned or whatever it might be. Brady material is typically material that an officer has been found to be dishonest in the past, although it can be broader than that. There's actually the way we are now seeing this whole Brady issue interpreted. It can include allegations of bias, can even include unproven assertions against an officer that an officer is dishonest or biased. It's a big deal to be on a Brady list, very significant. So what's this new case about? It comes out of the University of Oregon. By the way, I graduated, undergraduate from the University of Oregon, so I have a special affection for this case. There's a police department in the University of Oregon. It's a kind of a small public safety unit there. And this involves a fairly newly hired police officer named James Clevenger. He started working for the department in 2011. And it involves him getting crosswise with his police chief. The result, and this made a lot of news in Oregon, the result was that Clevenger was fired. Eventually, Clevenger files a civil lawsuit. The police chief ends up losing her job somewhat related to this. It's a big mess. Well, when Clevenger is fired, he brings a federal court lawsuit. And his allegation is that he was fired not because of any performance issues, but he was fired because the police chief retaliated against him for engaging in free speech. Whistleblowing was what his claim was. This goes to a federal court jury, and the jury ends up with, I think, kind of an interesting decision in that it ends up concluding that Clevenger, in fact, was retaliated against, and they award him a lot of money, $650,000 in economic damages, as well as punitive damages of $105,000. But the case, what's unusual about it is it doesn't end up turning on its termination. It ends up turning on whether or not there were any adverse employment actions taken against him other than the termination. I don't need to get into why that happened or, you know, the peculiar issues about how Section 1983 civil rights cases work. Just suffice it to say that the question that the court had to end up deciding when the university challenged the jury's verdict was whether or not a police chief wrongfully providing Brady information to a prosecutor was adverse action that could sustain a discrimination lawsuit. In other words, is the simple provision of information, Brady information, to the prosecutor, is that enough in the way of adverse action that it can support a free speech lawsuit or a Title VII lawsuit, any type of discrimination lawsuit? And the federal court ends up saying yes and upholds Clevenger's verdict. The court starts off by giving us a very familiar definition of what adverse employment action is, and that's whether or not a reasonable employee might have been dissuaded by whatever this employment action is from engaging in protected activity. The court ends up saying, yeah, a reasonable employee might well not engage in free speech if they thought the reaction from a police chief was to turn over potential Brady information to a local prosecutor. Now, the university's defense to this is, look, we didn't put the Clevenger on the Brady list. That was the prosecutor who put him on the Brady list. There's an independent actor here. And so all we did was provide information. The adverse action was him being placed on the Brady list. It wasn't us providing the information. And the court says, nope, I'm not buying that. And I'm going to read you a couple of sentences from the court's opinion. The court says, look, there's substantial evidence in this case that the submission of Brady materials to the DA can ultimately end an officer's career and future in law enforcement and probably prohibit the officer from getting hired again as a full-time police officer. The court says, I am not going to buy the argument from the university that what the department did here, turning over the potential Brady material, is analogous to mere scolding, threats, or harsh words such that it doesn't constitute an adverse employment action as a matter of law. Well, what about the university's independent actor theory here, that really it's just the DA who was the one who did the acting? The court says, remember who started it. It was the police chief who started it. The DA would have had nothing to act on. And in fact, the DA has an obligation once the police chief provides information, has an obligation to consider whether or not this is Brady material. And the court ends up saying, given that, simply providing the Brady material is enough of an adverse action to sustain this judgment for $750,000, plus, I'm sure, attorney's fees that will take this verdict into the million-dollar range. Brady cases are coming down now. They're almost coming down week by week. They're just all over the country, and all sorts of forms. This is probably as rapid developing an area of law as I've seen in my career. So stay tuned. No doubt in the next month or two, we're going to have more Brady cases. Well, that's it for this month. A couple of reminders. We have our collective bargaining seminar coming up in April of this year in Las Vegas, coming up in a couple of weeks. Go to our webpage, LRIS.com, to check it out. As you'll see, we're going to be covering everything from bargaining trends to I'll be talking about these midterm contract changes and impact bargaining and a lot of different things at that seminar. We'd love to see you there. And also, do come to our website and check out LRIS's new mobile app. It's something that we have designed for both public safety agencies and labor organizations as a way for them to communicate with their employees, with the public, and in the case of a union, to communicate with their union members about particular information. So with that, thanks for joining me. This is Will Aitchison signing off, and I'll be back with you in May.